The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I tend to speak very softly, so very much so, in fact, that when I gave the eulogy for a college classmate a couple of years ago, apparently nobody heard me but the deceased. So if I tend to sink down like that, since my eyes will be on the text, I won't be able to. It would not be impolite to just to say louder. Okay. One disclaimer I would like to get off my mind while I have an opportunity and a captive audience, which is, I am not the person intimately connected with the making of the motion picture, The Exorcist, who refused to believe so stubbornly that a human head, if spun 360 degrees around, will fall off the body and a great deal of blood will gush out. That was, I'm not pointing fingers, but that was not my decision. Now, in the novel, something else you should know, in the novel that I wrote just prior to The Exorcist, the hero is an astronaut who 2 days prior to a scheduled space shot confides to his medical officer that going to the moon is a touch uncouth and possibly bad for my skin, sir. And in the same afternoon, tells a Newsweek reporter who's interviewing him that his favorite novel is I Remember Mama by Oedipus Rex. And then that night, in the base dining hall, he's observed to pick up a plastic ketchup bottle, squeeze a thin red line across his throat, and then to get up and stagger over to a table then occupied by the director of the National Space Administration, throwing himself face down on it and gurgling, "Don't order the swordfish." All of which I burden you with in the, so rapidly dwindling hope that of disabusing you of the notion that my mind is frozen in the amber of some sort of Dantesque landscape teeming with demons and spinning heads. There isn't one of those within 17 billion miles of this novel, Demeter. I will come back to that theme and The Exorcist after I have done a wee bit of reading. Oh, I shouldn't have told you that. Now you're going to want me to speed through the reading. Too bad. Okay, this is in two parts, Demeter. And the first is set in the Albania of early 1970s. It was the first officially declared communist state. And lots of torture going on, lots of execution of priests of every denomination and all of that. 93 million miles from the sun, in the damp of a windowless concrete room in a maze of other rooms and cells and passageways where grace and hope had never touched, the interrogator sat behind a tight wooden table with a mind gone blank as the notepad before him. The prisoner radiated mystery. After 17 days of torture, he had yet to utter a word. Silent, his head bowed down, hands manacled, he stood beneath the blinding grip of the spotlight in the middle of the room, like a barrier to comfort. "Who are you?" The interrogator's voice was dry. All the questions had been asked. None had been answered. Now they all had worn away to the single probe, as if locked within the prisoner's name or his nature. "Who are you?" Drained, the interrogator waited, squinting at the sweat-blurred lines on the pad. In the hush of the chamber, he could hear his own breathing and the desultory, faint, sharp clicks of his penpoint tapping at the table's stained dark oak. For a moment, his ears twitched up minutely, straining toward a sound heard dimly through the walls, the scuffing of shoes, a body being dragged. He couldn't tell if the sounds were real or imagined. Here even the dust in the air was heard shrieking. Another odd sound intruded. What was it? The interrogator rested his pen on the table and lifted a haunted gaze to the prisoner, silent and motionless, yet so vivid that he seemed a disturbance embedded in time. Drops of blood were falling softly to the mottled stone floor from the ends of his fingers, now one, now another, where the nails had been wrenched from their sockets. The interrogator's fingertips touched at a scar that bisected his pale, thin lips into a snarl, and under the collar of his olive-drab coverall that bore no sign of rank, his neck felt strangely warm and taut. Against all reason, the prisoner frightened him, like the dark and heavy stars that show no color to the far observer. He blazed with a terrifying inner light. They had come upon him by chance. On a Sunday, 25 September, near the northern mountain village of Spock, a force of police, trained dogs, and militia had been hunting a suspect in the attempted assassination of Chief of Security Mehmet Shehu. Shots had been fired by unseen marksmen at Shehu in the city on a tour of inspection. Departed from security police headquarters, then housed in the ancient brownstone prison in that section of Shkodër called Rusi Mat. One man was caught, a present from Domny, who, under torture, finally implicated a second man from his village, a clothing merchant named Kazim Beg, who was believed to be escaping to Yugoslavia. Hunting parties sped to the routes considered likely paths of flight. To the west, the mud-brown river Buna, and north, the so-called Shepherd's Pass, a high coil at the crests of the Dukagini Mountains. Though swollen by unexpected rains, the Buna's roiling, buffeting waters could be crossed at the narrowest pinch of its waist, slightly more than 200 yards. But because it was known to so few Albanians and was close to the suspect's village, the pass drew the larger force of searchers. 58 armed volunteers and 3 dogs. Their climb was daunting, a robber of breath that spiraled through sandstone, marl, and shale to freezing heights of desolation. These were the ranges of the damned. But at the pass, the hunting force found no one and began a return that would have been without incident except for a curl of fate that would later be seen as first contact with the prisoner. One of the dogs, a ferocious mastiff of enormous muscle and bulk, had been loosed toward a crackling sound in the wood and was later discovered lying still amid gold and orange leaves on the forest floor in autumnal light as if fallen asleep and turned away from all yearning. Its neck had been broken. The leader of the force, a young smith named Rocco Bey, felt his shadow pass over him at the sight, for he could not grasp the power of a human capable of killing the dog in this way. His breath a white fire on the darkening air, he scanned the wood with narrowed eyes, sifting hawthorn and hazel in search of his fate, but seeing nothing but the cloud that is before men's eyes. The sun was descending. The forest was haunted. Bare branches were icy threats, evil thoughts. Bey thought of his mother. He slung his rifle over his shoulder and urged the force on and away from this place toward a secondary mission in Kaletsa, the capture of a murderer, a village baker. And while this objective was not to be gained, at the end of a labyrinthine path, another would, for their search would lead the hunting force to the prisoner. As you know, I am not reading continuously. Trying to give you a straight line sense of where it's going. And now, as the leader of that hunting force explains to Colonel Flora, the interrogator, in an interrogation, events take a somewhat eerie turn. And what then? Laura asks him. Well, I looked into the fellow's eyes. I knocked him unconscious with the butt of my rifle. Oh, he had a weapon? No? Then why? I don't know. Colonel, I really don't. I saw movement in the back of his eyes, some kind of struggle going inside of him. And in the instant, I was gripped by this crazy certainty that if he wished it, he could kill us all. I can't explain it. I'm sorry, Colonel. I just can't. You'd been sleepless for how long? 3 days, sir. Okay. What happened next? Well, we took him to the station house in Kalaitza, where we asked the police if our man had checked in with them when he'd first come into the village. And they told us no, which, of course, was suspicious. So I explained things completely to the local commissar and the commandant of police. So then the commandant asks him some questions. Well, the man wouldn't speak, not a word. And worse yet, all the wires to Thetty were down. There'd been a storm, and we couldn't check out any part of his story. As it happened, though, yeah, I thought, great luck. We ran into wonderful luck, sure. And Kalaitza at that moment was a merchant from Thetty. Big fellow, bald, very talkative. Anyhow, they found him. They brought him to the station. They asked him if he'd ever seen the prisoner before. He said, yeah. But he couldn't quite remember his name. But, oh, yes, our man was definitely from Thetty. And the commissar asked if he was Selka Dekani. And the merchant's face lit up, and he said, Ah, my God, of course, he's exactly, it's Selka. How in the world could I have possibly forgotten? Then he started to study our fellow intently, close up. And a curious look came over his face, and he told us, though he didn't know how it could have happened, he made an unbelievable error, for until that moment it had slipped his mind that Selka Dekani had been dead for many years, and that our fellow looked nothing like Dekani at all. What made his mistake so amazing, he told us, was that he had known Dekani quite well and had been so saddened and depressed by his death. The depression had lasted for months. It was all very strange. Yes. To say the least. So Dekani was a dead man roaming the hills, seeking momentary life and mistaken recollections. But then who was the prisoner? In Shkodër, he's tortured. He doesn't speak. They ship him to security headquarters in Tirana and into the hands of Colonel Vlora. For here there were methods and horrors and means. There were answers here to questions no one had asked. We pick up again with Laura having left the torture chamber. Laura turned his gaze to reports in a wire basket and lifted them out. They made an ambiguous rustling sound, the kind in which sometimes in the quiet of dawn one imagines one name has just been whispered. The answer was here, he felt, in these papers, though he'd pondered their contents so often before. Staring at the redness of a thing hid its greenness, he knew. He must look from the right point of view. But after hours of laboring at the papers, polishing and burning each fact, every riddle, and turning them end over end and around, before holding them up to the light of sense, no insight gleamed, no clue cried out its secret name, and at the end was the taunting fog of the beginning. And that certain touch of fear. Laura's eyes flicked up as a gentle whipping wind arose behind him, softly moaning and thumping at the window panes. Mysterious flashes danced in his spectacles, far lightning, memory of suns. Laura furrowed his brow and looked out upon the square below. In the flickering north, there were thick black clouds that was scudding toward the city from the mountains like the angry belief of fanatical hordes. And in a moment they would darken the square below and its anonymous granite government buildings, the broad streets leading drearily nowhere, and the rain-slick statue of Lenin commanding the empty storefront windows, crammed with the ghosts of a million longings, dust, and the dim recollection of hope. The interrogator's stare fell on a column of children, two by two, in their collarless tunics, as they trooped toward the Palace of Culture or some other of the square's monolithic museums. Flora furrowed his brow. The children had stopped. What were they gaping at, he wondered. Something below and out of view. And now other pedestrians stood and stared. Silent and motionless in the drizzle, they sprouted from the curbs like dead gray souls. The interrogator's knee joints cracked as he rose to scan the streets below, and then he saw it. In the middle of a sopping intersection, drenched in blood and dirty rain, lay the crumpled body of a Jesuit priest with pewter skin and sightless eyes, still searching for the answer to an interrupted prayer. While confined in a labor camp, he had baptized a newborn infant, and tried and found guilty of this offense, he'd been shot by a firing squad that morning. Now his corpse, wrapped in clerical robes and trussed like butcher's meat, had been dumped into the street where it would lie for 3 days to teach the people God's reach was shorter than a bullet's. The interrogator's eye caught a blur of motion, a tight, quick, furtive signing with the hand. Someone in the crowd had blessed himself. Blood pounded at the scar, slashing Laura's lips. And furious, he wheeled and rushed from his office down to the sodden streets below, without hat, without coat, and without companion, except for his rage and the scar's bright ache. But once outside the security building, he found only lifeless streets and the rain. And beneath the reckless, teeming sky, the body of the man who had purchased death on the cheap with a few sprinkled droplets of water. Flora's booted feet sloshed forward until he was standing by the body of the priest. The streets were deserted, nothing stirred, but Flora knew that they were there, the watchers. They were hiding. He could feel their wounded stares like burning sins upon his back. "Do you think this pig was a hero?" he bellowed. The words echoed damply in the concrete emptiness.
"Do you think that he loved you at all? Don't you know that his lies are what have kept you so poor, your children so ignorant and sick? You believe in the devil still? Well, there's your devil. He's there."
He had flung up his arm in accusation at the corpse, and he wheeled around pointing and shouting,
"He is there!"
Until at last a great weariness weighted his legs, and he faltered, his arm limply sagging to his side. Very slowly, Flora bowed his head, and with his clothes soaked through, his throat raw, he stood and listened to the rain-soft stitching of despair into the hardness of the stubborn, unwon streets. That is all I'm going to give you from part one. I will tell you the prisoner escapes and performs a rather stunning mission at the end of the Albanian section. I'm wondering how much time I have remaining for part two reading. Never mind. I shall go on. We open in Jerusalem 18 months later. Dr. Moses Mayo began each day as if expecting the world would end that night. He could find no other way to endure its griefs, the quiet terror of living in a human body. Waking at dawn's cool touch each day, by 7 he was hunkered down at his desk, munching poppy seed bagels and sipping sweet tea, as he greeted the Jerusalem Post grim headlines with a murmur, "Who cares? The world is ending tonight." But this early March morning found a different path. In his narrow staff quarters at Hadassah Hospital's medical school, the neurologist awakened in the tunnels of night with a quietly pulsing sense of dread. Wide awake, he lay still, staring up into darkness while he listened to the whirring and the flurry of his thoughts. He dreamed something strange, but what? Couldn't remember. He sat up, turned on a bedside tensile lamp, and squinted down at the tiny brass moon-faced clock, ticking loudly in the hush of a circle of light. Mayo groaned. It was minutes after 2 a.m. He sighed, swung his feet to the floor, and was cradling his lowered head in his hands when an overwhelming sadness, a depression, fell upon him. What was it, he wondered, the dream that he couldn't remember? dully staring at his curled up bony white toes, Mayo moodily wriggled them up and down. One of his patients had died the night before. Despondency and guilt always followed, he knew. Was that it? Or was it still the mad horror in the psychiatric ward? The shocking murder that no one could comprehend. Together in the ward for the last 4 months had been two inmates, each of whom believed he was Jesus Christ. Now there was only one. Mayo scratched at his scrawny chest through the flannel of a red and white striped pajama top and decided, no, neither one. Mayo dressed and boiled water on a single burner hot plate for the brewing of a heavily sugared tea in an oversized thick white porcelain mug, which he carried with him out into the dimly lit hall, where for a time he stood silent and still, irresolute, his head bowed down in thought and a hand in the pocket of a medical jacket that, just as with his rumpled baggy trousers, was much too large for his stick-like frame. He seemed not to wear his clothes, but to inhabit them. Miracles, he muttered. They'd been suddenly as common in these antiseptic halls as the moans of the soldiers in the burn ward at night. On Monday, a nurse named Samia Maroon had reported to him breathlessly that she had seen some sort of apparition. And then there was that two-year-old boy in the children's ward with rhabdomyosarcoma, a rapid-spreading, always fatal cancer. For weeks, the boy's x-rays had turned up a mass in his chest, growing steadily and ominously larger until, overnight, the mass vanished. Examining the x-ray, the confounded neurologist had murmured, "It's that damned elusive Pimpernel again." But as for the nurse's apparition, come on. Headed for his office, Mayo stopped as he came to a nurse's station where, behind a high corner, head bent low, a pretty dark-haired nurse in her 30s was entering notes into a patient ledger. "Good morning, Samia." "Good morning." Still writing, the nurse had not looked up, and her tone of voice was flat and cool. With a sigh, Mayo lowered his head and shook it. He had recently injured the nurse's feelings by scoffing at the story she'd excitedly told him concerning a patient named Isabel Lachme, an elderly woman with mild dementia who'd been recently crippled by a fracture of the lip. "I was checking on the burn case in 304 at 1 a.m, the nurse had recounted. "Moses, I hear some snuffling around in the hall, and I look up through the door, and who do I see walk by? I swear to God, no lie, Mrs. Lachme." "You're not serious." "I swear, absolutely, it was her, except she what?" "Well, she looked kind of rosy, you know, sort of youthful. And she turns, and she looks me straight in the eye, and she smiles. Well, my jaw drops a foot. I mean, I can't believe she's walking, right? So I blurted, hey, Mrs. Lachme. I was shocked. She walks on and out of sight. So I go after her, okay, but by the time I'm in the hallway, she's gone. There's no one there. She's disappeared. Samia, no, wait a minute. Wait until I tell you. I went straight to her room. She wasn't in her bed, you're going to tell me? No, she was in her bed. She was there asleep. Tell me, what is the point of this, Samia? The point is this. The next day, I'm in her room when her daughter comes to visit, and you told them that you saw. Can you stop interrupting, Moses? No, I didn't say a word. So now the daughter takes a hand, and she gives it a kiss, and I can see she's kind of shaky, you know, about to cry. Then she says to her mother how she wishes that she weren't always stuck in this bed. And then Mrs. Lachme, swear to God, honest truth, Moses. She says to her, oh, don't worry. I'm not stuck here at all. I go traveling with young people all the time. Then she turns to me, smiling. She says to me, and you know I'm telling the truth, don't you, nurse? Because you saw me last night. Oh, my God, Moses, I almost fainted. Can you believe it? No, the neurologist had instantly answered. Moreover, you haven't any right to be delusional, Samia. That's a privilege reserved for the chief physician and higher-ranking hospital staff. That had done it, Mayo ruefully reflected. He listened to the scratching of the ink-fed pen as the nurse kept writing head low to her task. She had told him she had seen something else that night. Mayo's gaze fixed dubiously on the crimson Star of David stitched into her oversized starched white cap. His quest for unwavering faith in her accounts had been less than heroically advanced by the fact that he knew her to be an erotic as well as a courageously innovative tester of the outermost limits of paranoia. Once she had bitterly and memorably complained that clerks at a grocer's near Jerusalem Hills, the inexpensive neighborhood where she lived, had refused to carry her bags or her car because, quote, that whole creepy staff in there is anti-Arab, whereas, in fact, the store's owners were all Palestinians. Mayo stood patiently waiting and hoping for the nurse to stop writing, till at last he gave up with a sigh and moved on. Instantly, the scratching of the pen behind him ceased. Now we jump a long way, and Mayo continues his amble down the hall, turning right in an intersecting corridor when he saw that light was spilling out of a window to the door to patient 422, and his spirits immediately began to pick up. The room's patient was Eddie Shore, the legendary 1940s big band leader who, at the brassiest peak of his fame, had inexplicably decided to give up music and retire to a farm in Northern Virginia to begin a career as a writer of novels. I wish to inject here that Eddie Shore is Artie Shore, who in his later years befriended me. And 90% of the dialogue written in here, Artie said to me. In Jerusalem, to research a historical novel that was to be set in the time of Christ, he was here at Hadassah not because of any neurological disorder, but rather with the symptoms of salmonella poisoning. Mayo picked up his pace. In his youth, an avid fan of Shore's music, Mayo had boldly introduced himself and had already had long conversations with his idol, in which he discovered him to be a completely unexpected human being, at once genial and warm and yet brusquely curmudgeonly, keenly insightful and brutally candid. Though at times, there was an air of evasiveness about him, when he would seem to deflect or evade a question, and sometimes pretending, Mayo thought, not to hear it. And it was on these occasions that a veil of mystery seemed to enshroud him. Almost totally bald, yet with high jutting cheekbones and a riveting stare that made him strikingly handsome even now in his 60s, Shore had been briefly and serially married to a number of Hollywood's most glamorous starlets. Once explaining to Mayo, who had asked him how he could possibly have cast them aside, "Are you kidding, Mayo? It was hard. I mean, how do you turn to this naked goddess lying in bed with you that every guy in the world wants to shtup and just tell her straight out, 'You bore me'? You think that was easy? For God's sake, think, Mayo, will you? Think." He had also confided what had caused him to abandon his career in music. "So one time, kid, I decided I'd do a very special tour. I mean, a tour with a really great band, top musicians in the country, the best. We're going to do original, innovative stuff, not that tired, dumb dreck that we played at the Paramount on Times Square right after Don Dickhead at the Mighty Wurlitzer was done and at colleges and high school proms. So I came up with some classy composite. No, really, they were great. They're really wild, wonderful stuff. I put this terrific band together, and we toured. And guess what? They hated it. They hated it. They booed Mayo. Every gig that we played, they'd start booing and yelling, 'We should play my big hits, all the popular faves.' And finally, I said, 'Oh, fuck it.' And I cut the tour short, and I went back to my penthouse apartment in Manhattan, where I stewed and I grumped and I farted around. And then I got really pissed. Really, really. And I go back to my booker, and I tell him to round up some hands. I was going to do another tour, but I didn't want to pay any more than minimum. He says, 'Minimum? Eddie, you crazy? You can't get good musicians for minimum. You'll get stiffs. You'll get trumpet players with emphysema.' I said to him, 'Stiffs are precisely what I want. I don't care if they can barely read music. I mean it. Make it happen.' So he gets me these guys, these bums who think sheet music's some kind of Rorschach test, and we go out. And we go out on this tour, and it's sounding putrid, just awful. The romantic Mantovani's greatest stock car racing hits. But we're playing all my biggies, my most popular numbers, all that Viennese pastry Mozart's wife used to throw in his face. And all the troglodytes, they're cheering, applauding, and stamping their feet. I can't believe it. I'm sick. I am disgusted. So, one night when we're playing, and I hold up my band to show the boys with my fingers what stanza comes next. We do it this way, Mayo. I'd hold up one finger, they'd go back to stanza one. I'd hold three, they'd go to stanza three. You know, you get the thing. So, but I held up my hand sideways so they couldn't see how many fingers were up. They had to guess. So these creeps, they all wound up playing different stanzas. It's sounding like galaxies in collision. Just cacophony, noise, sawmill sounds, total garbage. What happens? They give us a standing ovation. Hare Shore had stared glumly into space. Yeah, that's what did it, kid. That was it. I called off the rest of the tour that night, bought a farm, took up writing, and I've never looked back. Well, now, Maestro, you're up so late, or so early, I should say. Peering through the door's observation window and seeing Shore awake and sitting up in bed with pen in hand and a notebook and a notepad and face-down open book on his lap, the neurologist had breezed into the room and now was standing at the bottom of Shore's bed with his hands in the pockets of his medical jacket. Oh, hiya there, kid. Hey, what's happening, huh? What's up? Shore had slipped off his reading glasses and smiled as he recognized Mayo. Then he frowned a little, looking aside, and thought, oh, yeah, something got me up. I don't know what, something. You're feeling better? Oh, yeah, better, much better, Mayo, thanks. At least the headaches and the stomach cramps are gone. How are you? You okay? You look weird. Shore had craned his neck forward, squinting as he studied Mayo's face intently. No, you look like a guy who's just lost his best friend. Mayo's smile was thin and wan. Oh, I did that a very long time ago. Well, you look like you're fixing to do it again. Hey, come on, kid, sit up, pull up a chair. No, I see you working. I see you. I won't keep you. No, kid, I really want to talk to you. Really, sit down. Mayo loved it that Shore always called him kid. Shore picked up the book from his lap and he held it up. You know, as part of my research, I've been reading New Testament scripture. I think I found something new, something interesting here in this gospel. It's the Gospel of John. Sit down. You got to hear this. Mayo nodded and said, okay. And then slowly sat down in a chair by the bed. So what is it then, Maestro? Tell me. Shore slid his glasses back into place. You know this part here in John, he said, pointing to the open pages of the book. Well, maybe you don't. Of course not. But it's where they're stoning this woman for adultery. You know, I used to think every one of these stories were probably just bull. But guess what? There's a tell in here, a giveaway that tells you what isn't. It lets you know the story wasn't made up. And if you're a fiction writer, you see it immediately. Shore then avidly recounted that passage in John in which the Pharisees, hoping to embarrass Christ, brought before him an adulterous woman and asked him what he thought about the law of Moses that commanded such a woman be stoned to death. Christ, quote, bent over and wrote on the ground with his finger. Then he stood up and said to those who had confronted him, well, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. Then he bends to the ground and he writes some more. And then these momses, these Pharisees, they all took a hike. His eyes bright with the thrill of discovery, Shore hunched his body forward toward Mayo. Now, if that's in a novel, kid, if it's fiction, let me tell you something, Mayo. In fact, let me damn well guarantee you, in some chapter down the line, we're going to end all this pain-in-the-ass suspense and find out exactly what it was that Christ wrote. These gospels don't do it. Not this gospel. Not in any gospel. You don't ever find out what he wrote. Not a word of explanation, which to me says that's because the guy who wrote that gospel didn't know what he wrote, and not knowing, he didn't make something up. Mayo gently nodded his head. His thoughts were adrift. Very nice, he said. Very nice? That's really all you have to say? Very nice? I, the Sherlock Holmes of the Judean desert, have just proved that not all these gospels are made-up stories. To you, it's just like I played a riff on a cello. Are you deaf or just a putz of interplanetary standing? Mayo looked up with a speculative air. This is something rather new for you, isn't it? What do you mean, new? His eyes narrowed, and Shore's evasive persona now appeared. Aren't you Jewish? Mayo clarified. Huh? For a moment, Shore stared blankly. Then he softly uttered, "Oh, oh." And he put his head back on a pillow. The guarding veil and the tension in his face had disappeared. "Yeah, I'm Jewish to the core," he said, staring up at the ceiling pensively. "Still in all, you've got to wonder, don't you think? Here are these guys, pretty young, some barely literate. They're fishermen, whatever. One minute they're all totally depressed and crapping their pants behind locked doors because they're all terrified of guilt by association, that they're going to be rounded up and crucified next. Then all of a sudden they're these death-defying maniacs climbing onto rooftops yelling, 'Come and get me, copper!' And they go out on the road breathing fire and doing real fun stuff like getting the crap beaten out of them, tortured and thrown into jail, getting killed, even crucified upside down for preaching big-time, winning popular ideas like, 'You've got to love your enemy,' and 'No more divorces. Plus, incidentally, our dead guy isn't dead anymore, and you've got to eat his flesh and drink his blood.' All winners, all easy sell. But these frightened mugs do it. They actually do it. In less than 20 years, they're recruiting in Rome and are practically taking it over. What do you call that, Mayo? You got to wonder. Something happened to these guys, something big, like maybe even a resurrection. I don't know. But they sure must have thought they'd seen him walking around. You know, getting killed is an awful lot of trouble to go to just because you're feeling bored and the fish aren't biting. For a moment, Shore paused, and then he cryptically added in a pensive tone, "You know, sometimes you get into situations, Mayo, and you have to start thinking about these things." A long silence ensued, causing Shore to turn his head to scrutinize Mayo, who was staring at the floor in an effort to recall his elusive dream. Shore frowned. "Kid, you've got this zombied out look again, you know? It's just like this temp fill-in drummer that I picked up in Phoenix one time. He'd heard that pandas get high on eucalyptus leaves, so they wound up his drug of choice, and he'd be doing these lazy slow-mo brush sweep, slack jaws, staring straight out at the crowd with that same spacey look that's on your face right now, just without the purple teeth. You've been listening to anything I've been saying?" "Oh, yes, yes, everything, maestro, everything." Mayo stood up. "Listen, I better go. I'm not feeling too well myself." Oh, it's too bad. Take care of yourself, kid, will you? You too." Smiling wanly, Mayo turned and left the room to continue his drift through the hospital's halls, stalked by specters of light and of darkness, of miracles and murders and the need to find an answer to an overwhelming question that no one had asked or could even formulate. Until finally, just before dawn, and without any notion of how he had gotten there, he found himself standing in front of the gray metal entry door to the psychiatric ward on floor 7. Pasted onto it, random bright thoughts from elsewhere, were a large crayon drawing of a rainbow and another of a clutch of blue and yellow daisies. There was also a photo of a staff clinician, a smiling young woman in a medical jacket. "Sarah," Mayo murmured fondly. The door was never locked. Beyond it were patients who were thought to be harmless, a woman addicted to plastic surgery, elderly victims of dementia, and odd assorted others, such as a professor of deconstructed English, whose daily attire while teaching class had included knee-high paratrooper boots and a sinister shiny black leather jacket. He had once been ejected from the Club 2000 in Old Jerusalem for allegedly, quote, emitting threatening vibrations while standing at a pinball machine. "And so why am I here?" Mayo wondered again. "The murdered Christ?" "Ah, At this, Mayo thought of Sergeant Merrill, recollecting the haunting thing he had told him after shepherding the murderous Christ to Kfar Shoal, an asylum for the criminally insane just outside of Jerusalem's walls. On returning to Hadassah to brief the sub-district police on what had happened, Merrill said, well, he was silent all through the ride until, trying to give him some comfort, I told him he was now the only Christ in the city. And then for the very first time, he spoke to me. He said, no, there is another. Mayo stared at the colorful drawing of the daisies, his fingertips absently brushing at his chin. He felt that icy mist of foreboding settling lightly once again on the back of his neck as he wondered what any of it could mean. Then abruptly, with a grunt and loose flip of the hand, Mayo turned and shuffled toward the elevator back. So what of it? The neurologist mentally harumphed. This is all a Middle Eastern Marley's ghost, a bit of undigested lamb. But as also occurs in the subatomic world, where electrons, like saints with bleeding hands, are reportedly seen in two places at once, Mayo soon would abandon the uses of sense and come to radically change his mind when Eddie Shore was found dead in his bed hours later without a cause that would give up its name. It was morning, and then would come night. I think I am over time. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. We are off to look. Nobody here has had time to read Dimiter, so I don't expect any of you to ask me questions about it. You may ask me about anything, or I could entertain you with a very interesting exorcist story. Here comes the hall monitor.
That was a setup. Why don't you start us off with the story?
Okay. This would be a follow-up to my introductory remarks. Even when I was working on The Exorcist, this irresistible urge to do something funny would stick up its head like the Loch Ness Monster from time to time. And it was a Friday. We'd finished filming, and Bill Freak and I were having a drink on 57th Street in New York somewhere. And he told me that on Monday we were starting the whole exorcism sequence. And he said, Ellen was very nervous. He said, I wish we could think of a way to relax her. Teacher, I know a way. What? Well, the opening scene, for those of you who haven't read the book or seen the film, the doorbell rings, and Ellen Burstyn goes to the door, and she opens it, and there is a man in a black priest garment and overcoat and hat, and he removes the hat that's covering his face. He says, Mrs. McNeil, I'm Father Marin. I said, instead of Max Fonsito, don't tell Ellen ahead of time, let's dress up Joe Fretwell as a priest, right? Joe was our Southern costume designer, and with him knocking at the door, it would have sounded like this. Ms. McNeil, hi, I'm Father Marin. Billy said, no. No? No, not Fretwell. Groucho Marx. Bill, are you serious? Would you do that? Sure I would. Billy, I know Groucho. I was a contestant on You Bet Your Life. I won the big jackpot, and I also said the secret word, for those of you who don't know about it. You said some word randomly selected by the TV staff before the show. I said work. I remember it. This plastic duck would drop down from the ceiling with a placard in his teeth with the word work, or whatever the secret word was. And he said, to Sherry Netherlands, you want to do it? Yeah, Monday. Great. I met with Groucho at the Russian Tea Room on Sunday. And there the script expanded. We weren't just going to do the opening of the door to relax Ellen Burstyn. Groucho was then going to follow Jason Miller up the staircase in front of Regan McNeil's bedroom, exchange a little bit of dialogue with Ellen Burstyn, and then opens the door and he walks in and stops confronting Eileen Deeds, who is Linda Blair's stunt double, in the full demonic makeup, stretched out with her arms, wrists tied to the padded posts of this four-poster bed. And the moment Groucho stops, she was to shriek the, I think it's this, there may be others, I don't know, but single vilest obscenity in the English language. 10 letters, begins with a C, and the duck would drop down. And the plan, there is more, the plan was to send it to Warner Brothers executives bundled up in L.A. with, you know, the other dailies of that day. And then for at least a couple of days, we were not going to take their calls. Groucho could only do it on Monday. Billy was, I think, psychosomatically sick on Monday. I think he felt we were so over budget that if we pulled off that stunt, I don't know what would have happened back in L.A. But one little tiny vignette. All through my meeting with Groucho, I was facing toward the front door, and right below the maitre d' station, there was a little bench, and there was a rotund man with a spiky, curly black mustache sitting there with his hands over a gold-topped cane. And as we were walking out, he jumped up, and the maitre introduced him. It was turned out to be Salvador Dali, dying since childhood to meet Groucho Marx, I guess. And all I heard, Dali spoke, did not speak English. All I heard him say was, butta boof, butta boof. I think I'm pretty sure he was describing Groucho as a great, big, colorful, crazy butterfly. Anyway, that was it. Except we went out into the street, and by the street corner, some kid comes up to Groucho. Oh, Mr. Marx, you are the most wonderful comedian. I love you. What are you doing out of school? I'm through with that.
Now you know why I said we should start with a story. Who would like to start with a question?
Yes,
right,
sir.
Here on the aisle. If you could wait for the mic, please.
Thanks very much. Can you share any stories about what it was like working with Neville Brand, Richard Lynch, and the rest of the cast, Joe Spinell, on Twinkle, Twinkle, Killer Kane?
In Budapest, Lebanon, Hungary, I had gathered to shoot this film, what turned out to be six of the most genuinely eccentric, borderline crazy actors, and Neville was among them. Neville Brand was either the second or third most decorated American soldier in World War III. And the cute story that wasn't a story. Jason Miller once said to me at dinner one night, "You know, Bill, think Neville is lonely for his BAR." This is his Browning automatic rifle. And Neville had, this is one feat he had performed. Patton's army was held up on a road by a German pillbox up on top of a commanding hill, narrow road, machine guns, everything. And they dispatched Neville to crawl toward the place. And this is how Neville describes wanting to be in show business. He got to a certain point, and he looked behind him, and there's the whole Eighth Army, these tanks. And he thought, they're all waiting for me. This is show business. that's when the bug hit him. He went in. He slowly opened the door and annihilated, I don't know how many soldiers, that box. And I asked him, "Neville, when you opened the door, what were you thinking?" "Nothing. Nothing. I wasn't thinking anything. I just pulled the trigger. Oh, we had a lot of fun. One morning at 3, Jason Miller and Joe Spinell knock on my door. I have to be up at 6. They come in. This is what has happened. In the top floor of the Budapest Hilton, there was a discotheque. And they had been up there very late. And Jason walked over to a table then occupied not by the director of the National Space Administration, but by the Nigerian ambassador to the United States. And he asked, I don't know if she was his wife, his girlfriend, whatever, very pretty girl to dance. And the ambassador, instantly, for handicap, just overturned the table. He was enraged by this. And various bottles of liquor were flying through the air, and Mr. Spinell wielded one of them that knocked the Nigerian ambassador on the head, knocked him out. We're going to have a fun day with the Budapest Gestapo that day. There they were. Would you believe Spinell actually said, "Guy pulled a knife on us." Joe Spinell also was ejected. He was not staying at the Budapest. He was in the Gellert Hotel downtown. And they had this ancient, you know, Roman marble floor in the hotel. And he was ejected for roller skating. And he always pleaded his innocence. I said, "You didn't do it." "No, there's a frame up there, nothing." He said, "They're picking on us." "Joe, why is it that the Hungarian police would invent a charge of roller skating against the only person in our cast and crew who owns a pair of roller skates? How has that coincidence worked out?" Ah, he walked away from it at this point. They all got off. We went on shooting. That was an enchanted time. It really was. Actually, we lost. The cast consisted, the leads, the astronaut was Michael Moriarty. And no, not at first. I cast Michael Moriarty, perfect. And big mistake, Nicole Williamson was King. Nicole Williamson hung around my house in Georgetown for almost a week doing his American accent, which consisted of him imitating Gregory Peck in 12 O'Clock High. "Now, I've been sent here to take charge of a hard luck group. Well, I don't believe in hard luck." Little did I know that that was the only American accent speech he could do. And then I saw him. He was doing the "Don't Order the Swordfish" speech. And he crossed his legs, and I saw this 13.5-inch stiletto of a shoe. Said, "This is not a man who killed 83 men with his hands. I cannot do it. I can't go on." Michael froze. He froze up on me. He started whispering. He was intimidated by Nickel, who at the first day's reading knew not only every word of his dialogue, he knew every word of Michael Moriarty's dialogue. And as the reading went on, Michael's voice grew softer and softer. Inevitable. And Ed Flanders told me, "Bill, you hear that tone? Yeah. That's what you're going to get at the end of the movie." Was he a dumb movie? Too bad. Well, I had also gone to Michael's office room the night before. Well, I was going to shoot a test the next day. And I said, "Are you all ready?" "Oh, yeah." See, and he held up his script. And there were little squiggles. What do those notes mean? Typewritten notes. "Oh, no, those are breath stops. They're breath stops." "Yeah. All acting is breathing." And I didn't say anything. He said, "For example, here's Hamlet. Uh, I knew I was in so much trouble because I had put some of my own money into making this film. And the next day's test bore everything out. It was a Friday now. And Monday, I shot around Kane. I cast Scott Wilson, who was in our cast, upgraded him to the astronaut's part. I took George DiCenzo and gave him Scott Wilson's part, and I had to take then George DiCenzo's part from the crazy doctor, Lieutenant Frome. And Tuesday, Stacy Keach showed up and gave the performance of his life. That was a truly mind-bendingly nervous time. I had never directed. But guess what? Woody Allen was right. I keep hearing different percentages. The way I heard it, Woody Allen said, 75% of directing is just showing up. So I'm the first one on the set in the morning, having not slept a wink all night. And someone, you know, the cinematographer came in first. And he said, well, Bill, which way do you want to shoot? Are we going to shoot in that direction? I said, yeah, that sounds good. Then he walked away and got his crew together, and they started lighting. Then a costume man came in. Bill, how about this? Does this look all right for the... Yeah, perfect. Love it. And that's how it went. I just went answering questions. It was so great. The point at which I became truly dangerous is when I finally thought I knew what I was doing. Everything was downhill from then.
How about another question?
Any other questions about anything, whatever? Sir.
Gentleman all the way in back on our left.
Thanks. I came in a little late, and maybe you addressed this in before your reading.
Oh, shall I read everything again?
No, that's okay. But my question is about your experience with Albania, if you had any. Did you go over there? Did you?
I did not go to. I was in Jerusalem. I'm sorry. I was in Jerusalem for weeks on end. I did not go to Albania. I did book research, and I talked to many, many people who had fled Albania at that particular period of time. You know, they gave me great, great detail. Great detail. Anything else?
Another one in back, gentleman in green.
You were friends with the director, Friedkin?
Oh, yes. We are still friends.
Did you work on the screenplay for The Sorcerer?
No.
Okay.
No, I did not.
The reason why I asked is the movie it was based on, the French movie, it was one of my favorite films, Wages of Fear.
Billy and I had been set to collaborate on a UFO film. And at the point at which I told his agent, I don't want to spend the rest of my life working on this. 6 months, that's it. Billy decided to trash it, and he went on to Sorcerer. I thought that Sorcerer would have been a masterpiece if he had not done the prelude, which Clouseau never did. At the beginning, he had a vignettes of each of the men in the truck riding along with the nitro and the dynamite. Each of them was a total scumbag. And so when the film came out, I tried to tell Billy through his agent, you know, in the original film, you're tense with every little bump in the road coming up in that dilapidated truck that the whole thing is going to go up. But I hate these guys. I want it to go up. And I have a feeling much of the audience is going to feel the same way. Other than that, I thought he had a classic film there. He does, too, to this day.
Gentleman in green.
Hello, Mr. Friedkin. The masturbation scene in your novel is one of the is one of the most horrific.
I get no respect.
It's one of the most graphic and horrific scenes in novel history. It's one of the greatest horror novels, but one of the most graphic scenes. When the screenplay was written, did you get a lot of flack from the Catholic Church to omit it, or from the producers, or anything like that?
The reviews from official Catholic quarter. The first review I got of the novel was in Civiltà Cattolica, which is the Jesuit house organ of the Vatican, if they're literary, quarterly. And it was a rave by Padre Mandrone. And the New York Catholic News, that's the diocesan paper for the city of New York, called it a deeply spiritual film, gave it 4 stars. That was their top. And Cardinal O'Connor, I read in Time magazine, actually quoted from the novel in one of his Sunday Mass homilies. That's where the official church stood. Nevertheless, as soon as I showed up in New York for the filming, an old friend from the days I was in the Air Force and stationed in Beirut rang me up, and she was the wife of the managing editor of Time magazine. Let's have lunch. Oh, so we had lunch like half a block away from where we were filming on 41st Street. And her parish priest, he said, why would you make such a film? I mean, it's not just that scene, all of it. Oh, our parish priest thinks it's an abomination and this and that. No use to tell her that I had heard that the Pope liked it. Didn't matter, you know. And so you can imagine the review the film got in Time magazine. Yeah, especially after he heard I had lunch with his wife. Yeah.
Was in a lot of states of the Union when showed the movie years later.
Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised in the kind of the reaction?
No. I was offended by the opening of the film. But I also thought it contained at least three of the funniest comedic set pieces I have, and I include the producers, I include them all, that I've ever seen in my life. And, you know, once I got by, that was just me, that opening nativity scene, please. I thought it was in great good humor. I really did. I didn't think it was offensive. You know, it's the night before the football game skit on a college campus. That's what it added up to.
Okay, well, I think that's where we're going to end it. William Peter Blatty, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.